Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, and not a solo episode today because I have a special guest, someone that I've worked with for a very, very long time, someone that actually has more years in the publishing industry than myself, and that is my good friend Piper Lafrano. Piper, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, everyone.
So I found it odd because we were talking before and you've actually never been on the show before, which is wild to me.
I know. This is my first podcast ever.
So just to give everybody a little bit of background, maybe tell people a little bit about sort of your experience in this space. I know our listeners would probably be delighted to hear that you've worked with, I have no idea, but how many publishers you think over the years?
Oh, yeah. Probably thousands.
Yeah.
Because it'll be, this is in October, will be 10 years at Ezoic.
Wow.
Yeah, a decade. Yeah, which is a decade in the space. And when I came on board was when we just started offering Ezoic as a service. And so I came on as one of the first salespeople working with publishers, getting them onboarded to Ezoic back in the day, layout tester days.
Yeah.
And actually, we still work with some of the sites that I brought on back then,
which is
really cool to see.
I know. And it's a decade in any technology industry, especially like over the last decade, there's been so much change and stuff. I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone working on, you know, almost any platform for that long, much less one in the publishing space. Before we get into kind of like the news of the day, I'm curious, like, what are like the biggest changes you've seen over the last maybe 10 years or so that like stick out to you, how things are different now than they were, you know, back when
at Ezoic or in the space?
I guess in the space, like what's difference, like what's changed for publishers in terms of like the ones that you see and sort of like what they're worried about, and I guess maybe what's changed just overall that maybe has impacted that.
Yeah, I would say I do think the distribution of content has changed a lot. So I remember at the very early days of 10 years ago, it was pretty much all organic traffic. Publishers didn't have as much reach on social media platforms and different distribution channels. So I've seen that change a lot. And also now there's so many social media platforms and publishers can drive a business from a single one. So that's been something that's
Facebook
changed a lot.
Pages were kind of big, like maybe 10 years ago, or was that around the time that Facebook started really shooting the reach in the head?
It was like, I would say like 2015, 2016 was when we saw like a huge influx of Facebook pages and publishers driving content that way. That's been one of the biggest changes, I think. It's hard to like think back over 10 years and like try and remember what it was like back then. And then I just think like at Ezoic specifically, like the technology has improved so much. And I think it's just gotten so much easier for publishers. And this is not just at Ezoic, anywhere. I think it's gotten easier for publishers to access different technologies to help them build their business.
It's definitely, technology has become more available and accessible. And I think things like cloud and lightweight technologies and things like that have made, you know, the ability for one person to run and do a lot of things that, I mean, in many cases, it wasn't even a matter of expertise. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a matter of like access to like servers or supercomputers in the cloud or whatever. But I think with that, you know, like ability, it sort of puts this burden on publishers to know and understand a lot of these things.
Because for sure.
It's somebody will, and you know, that person is theoretically a competitor. You know, like somebody else that's writing and creating content with lower overhead if they have expertise that you don't. So do you think that's getting better or worse?
I would say, to be honest, I would say it's getting worse. The most recent example I have of this is Core Web Vitals. They are so difficult to improve. And if you're not a developer and don't understand how to go in and make changes to the code, you're kind of at a loss and you need help with it. And so we expect publishers who are supposed to be experts in their niche, writing great content, to now be developers, to be SEO experts, to understand monetization, to do all these things. And so they have to wear a lot of hats. And I do think things like that put the burden on publishers to either learn it themselves, outsource it, which is expensive, or find technology partners that can help.
Yeah. And I agree with you. And I think that, you know, devout listeners of this podcast will know sort of the distraction that I think speed can become. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think, you know, it is one of those things to where, you know, like I said before, where you know that somebody out there has the skill set to work on that, and to maybe it's even easy for them. And, you know, like to try to then work backwards, become an expert on that. And mm-hmm. then, you know, that person may have built something from scratch that's already optimal for that. And then, you know, to try to back engineer whatever you've got.
Yeah.
It's much harder to do that than it is to, you know, start from the right sort of foundation from the beginning.
For sure.
And for a lot of publishers, I would say, like, you know, I remember when mobile first and mobile friendly was a thing, you know? And so it's not even a matter of, you know, starting with the right foundation. These things weren't prerequisites whenever most publishers that, you know, we've worked with over the years started. So, I definitely feel that burden for publishers that are trying to learn these things. And
mobile first is a great example, because, you know, I've worked with publishers who started their websites at the beginning of the internet, and they've posted content since then. And back then, mobile wasn't a thing. And now they're expected, well, when it was mobile first and mobile friendly, to have a mobile friendly website after having a website for years and years and years that wasn't mobile friendly. And they might have the best content, but they don't know how to convert it into a mobile site. And so, yeah, I think sometimes the technology is a burden, like we said, but also I think it does allow publishers with more resources. So big, like, conglomerates or, you know, media companies that aggregate lots of sites to have more reach than the publishers, the independent publishers who have the best content.
Yeah, it's a catch-22, and it's a double-edged sword, whatever double entendre you like. It's one of those things where the larger publishers, it's a risk to them as well, because, you know, they've always had the resources to sort of outcompete independent publishers. But now, because of the resources available and the technologies that are out there, you know, they can get disrupted by somebody that's much smaller with lower overhead and that runs a better business. And so they have to adapt as well. So there is this sort of balance. And I think the one thing that is sort of, like, encouraging and I think magical about the publishing space is that the ecosystem has provided an avenue for all to succeed.
Definitely.
In one form or fashion. And I think that's why, you know, one of the things that I think has made this show popular is that we talk about the topics that are sort of, like, emerging each week. And it really is fascinating how quickly things in this space change. Mm-hmm. And speaking of change, there's been some robust social media changes here over the last week or so. So as of Sunday and Monday morning, it was final. Twitter has essentially completely rebranded Twitter. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, maybe even calling it Twitter won't be appropriate, but it's renaming itself as X, which is Elon's sort of, like, you know, overlying brand that he's sort of had out there for a minute. But Twitter is going to take on this X brand, and they've gotten rid of the birds. I like to think it's Elon's subtle way of telling us that maybe, you know, birds aren't real. And it's just a subtle way of him letting us know.
That's definitely what he's doing.
But, you know, what does this say about the Twitter brand? I think that there's a lot of things about this from a marketer's perspective I look at and I find a little bit puzzling. But at the same time, I think I also maybe get it. So I guess what's your take on the Twitter rebrand to X?
I don't know if I understand all of Elon Musk's decisions.
I don't know that Elon understands.
I don't think anyone does. So I don't read into it that much. I don't try to understand. From a marketer's take, what do you think?
Well, I do think that there is, like, some merit to it. You know, the publishers on this podcast are like, the redirects, the SEO. there is, I think, an element of that that's probably like not was not thought through, mm-hmm. At least by Elon probably. And then I think this idea of a super app, which I think is the goal of the X thing, is I've heard him talk about it before, where he imagines it being like a lot of the apps in China, where you mm-hmm. have your social media. It's like a PayPal, Twitter, Amazon, and like a Square Payments, or just it's like an all-in-one app where you like almost kind of like Apple Pay, if Apple like also ran Twitter and mm-hmm. Amazon or something like that. And I don't see how in the United States you're ever going to have something like that that is going to be allowed by regulators to
any degree. Also, I just think that I have a hard time understanding the super app, and I know that, you know, in China and some Asian countries, they're very popular, but...
And also permitted.
Right, right. Right. But for me, when I think about the way that I use different apps, I have a different intention with each.
Yeah.
And so I have a hard time wrapping my head around going to one app to do everything.
I mean... For somebody that has been unable to log into their Twitter for over 3 to 4 months, like, thank God, you know, yeah. I'd be trying to take money out of ATMs, yeah. and just, like, keep cash on me at all times. So I'm kind of with you there. I do appreciate sort of like the synergy of technologies that work together. So like all of my hardware is Apple, and the OS and the systems and the apps that I have, they all work very mm-hmm. seamlessly together. You could say the same thing about like an office suite, whether you use the Google Workspace or Microsoft Office. You know, you generally want to use all the technologies in that suite, as mm-hmm. opposed to like picking and choosing best of breed from different systems and platforms, because mm-hmm. they just work well together. And so I do see a benefit there, but I also sort of look at sort of like each of these things as distinctly separate, where you do have suites of different tools where, you know, like, from a work standpoint, like I wouldn't want to be forced to use, you know, like Sketch or something like that, you know, on all my Apple devices. I'd rather use Adobe. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think people will always find that sort of like balance between like best of breed and then like industry or system specific software. So I don't know that this rebrand is going to have a huge effect. I know a lot of people have talked about platforms like Mastodon mm-hmm. and maybe I forget the other one's name, like there's like a Dust or Particle or something like that. Sounds like dirt in the air, can't remember, probably getting it wrong, but yeah, there's been a handful of those. I always find that anything that is like that, where people are like, oh, everybody's getting on this one, mm-hmm. I don't see it. But I'm notoriously bad at predicting social media. So what do you think? Have you tried out any of these other like Twitter alternatives, Threads perhaps?
I downloaded Threads this morning before mm-hmm. the podcast.
I have downloaded, I have not set up an account.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it imports all your Instagram users, yeah. so you immediately have followers and are following people. So I've played with that a little bit. To be honest, personally, trying to take a step back from social media.
Healthy.
But yeah, I think with the rebranding, my biggest concern with his decision is I feel like when he took over Twitter, a lot of the users weren't optimistic about the future. And I wonder if rebranding Twitter is now going to create more longtime users who no longer see a future there and move to other platforms.
I mean, I'm a 14-year account holder that cannot log in. It would be great if I could, but they're going to, I mean, they essentially have lost me as a customer without, I mean, like, I would love to not be lost as a customer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't know. I actually listened to another podcast about, what's been happening at Twitter recently, and the limiting that they're doing on the number of tweets that people can access. Obviously, the blue verification check mark that you can pay for now, yeah. which has lost its credibility. Doesn't seem like Twitter is in a good financial standing. And now this, it just seems like a lot is happening over there.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that's one area where I think a lot of platforms get it wrong, because I think ads always wins has been like a philosophy mm-hmm. of mine for a long time in media. And that like, if you're a business model that has ads at least as a like mainstay centerpiece, like the chances of you succeeding long term and just being a viable business are really strong. Those that always try to like either eliminate or rely on other forms of revenue as a primary, you know, like the future is pretty murky there, and mm-hmm. the track record of pretty much every like business in that space is not great. Like, I mean, you can think of, you know, like maybe one exception in almost every category where it kind of works, like HBO, for example, mm-hmm. it's like kind of works, but they're definitely the exception that proves the rule. And I think with something like Twitter, the thing that that could be its undoing is probably in that category for me, where I do think that they've done something, or Elon has done something that may just be him. And so that may not be something that scales, but you know, Twitter is the conversation, you know, that's always mm-hmm. the advantage that it's had. Like Threads, I think is a failure waiting to happen, in that, you know, like Twitter is Twitter because that is where the conversation goes. I don't follow my friends necessarily on Twitter. I go there to get information. You access, it's kind of like the conversation of what's going on topics, the world, etc. Threads is my friends and stuff. Right. And I already have social media for that.
Yeah. I mean, that goes back to my whole like super app not working for me, because you have different intent with different platforms. So Twitter, same thing. Like I follow thought leaders, people in the industry, news, that type of thing. Instagram, it's more friends, family, maybe some influencers. Do I want to hear their innermost thoughts on Threads? Not necessarily. So the intent is different for both of those. I mean, when I logged into Threads this morning, it was mostly just reposts from what was posted on Instagram.
Yeah.
That's how it's being used right now. Maybe a few thoughts in there. None of my friends are really using it. I also don't know if they use Twitter though, so, because I don't follow them on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, that is another thing too, where it's like, I would say almost all the people in my life that I have like, you know, regular contact with have an Instagram or, you know, like a TikTok or a Snapchat or something like that, but they don't necessarily have Twitter. Mm-hmm. And because they don't use it, or yeah, they're just not active on it. It's not something they're interested in. Yeah, so I agree with you there. And I think that, yeah, I'm not sure that Threads, if you're a publisher out there, is worth a huge investment of like time mm-hmm. and resources in terms of exploring it as a traffic avenue yet. I mean, definitely, I'm a fan of experimenting with everything, but yeah. I would say like, I'd be weary of a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow right now. And speaking of weary of something, have you heard of this Carly Russell story? This was something in particular that I'd sent ahead of time, because it's something that I wanted to talk about, and it was all over social media, speaking of social media, mm-hmm. Last weekend.
Yeah, well, I am also a true crime podcast listener, devout listener. So I had heard about it, not a full episode on it, but people talking about it when it happened. And then I read the article that you shared yesterday, and it's pretty wild.
Yeah. So for our listeners that are unfamiliar with what we're talking about, Carly Russell was a young Black woman that I believe she was a college student, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so she had called 911. This is a brief synopsis of the story. I won't get too far into it. Just give everybody context. She'd pulled over on the side of the road and called 911 because she claimed that she saw a toddler walking alongside the road.
A busy highway.
A busy highway, yeah. And so she pulls over. I guess she was on the phone with someone when all of a sudden, like, she just stopped responding to the person on the other end. And when the police got there was no toddler. The car was there. I think her phone might have actually been there as well. I can't mm-hmm. remember. And it like kind of blew up on social media. There's this missing person, right? Mm-hmm. And for 48 hours, there was a GoFundMe, I think, that raised $42,000 set up in the time period. And then the next I heard about it was that she showed up magically back at her parents' house 48 mm-hmm. hours later. And like at the time, the story was just like, and details still haven't emerged yet on what happened. And then I haven't got to read a lot of the in-between, but I guess in the in-between, she claimed to have been kidnapped by like a trucker.
Yes.
And it was kind of a bizarre story, but she had escaped somehow. And ultimately, here over the last couple of days, she's admitted that it was a hoax, and she didn't mean to, you know, harm anybody or anything like that. But I feel like the FBI, they dug in even deeper than they probably needed to, but they had found on her phone like how to fake a kidnapping.
Oh, I know. All yeah. that kind of stuff. How to make money off of an Amber Alert was one I think she had searched.
Yeah. How to make money off an Amber Alert. And then they also had things in there too where it's like how to steal money out of a register. And I guess she looked up a particular type of register that she had at the job that she had or something like that. So I feel like that's them just being like, well, we're just throwing this one out there too, so you're probably going to lose your job. But the thing that I find really interesting about it is just you think about the amount of content that this story produced at every level, you know, everything from like, we don't know what's happening, it's a kidnapping. But somehow, just like anything that has like mainstream appeal, you know, the sort of identity politics angles have also come out in this. And you know, I have to admit, like I read a bunch of them and there's a part of my soul that hurts when I read the ones that are sort of like, you know, they hone in on the fact that she's a Black female. And then you'll find like ones where it's like, even though it was a hoax, like we should support her. And then these other ones that are like, you know, this is a great example of the media blowing up a story just because of this or that. And it just, you hate to see that kind of stuff because it's just like, it's so junk food and polarizing and negative. Mm-hmm. But it gets views and it gets a lot of attention. And I think that that's something that, you know, as a publisher, the struggle is always like, you know, what do you write about, you know? And if you're a publisher and you maybe have like a whole website on kidnapping, there's probably at least one out there.
Oh, for sure.
You know, you might not want to write about something like that, you know, but by dragging in identity politics, that does produce views. So I guess, you know, one of the things that I think that web publishers struggle with that YouTubers get right is that YouTubers from day one lean into the things that drive an audience because they're directly connected to it. Like I started getting lots of views. I see the comments. So I start making content for my audience. Publishers, on the other hand, they're kind of one step removed because so many of them get their traffic from Google. I think they're not maybe as in tune with the data. And so it does beg the question when the data tells you should write about, you know, an identity politics angle on a topical news story, you do have a decision to make. And I find that interesting. Like, what would you do?
Oh, that's a hard question. Are you encouraging people to post extremist content?
God forbid.
God.
Google would never let us run this podcast on anything that they, or definitely wouldn't let us run ads on the podcast, right?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a hard one for me. Because it does get clicks, it does get views. I think YouTubers have tapped into that. TikTokers are very good at that. That's a really hard question. I mean, I'm a very fact-driven person, so I like the facts, but I know that that's probably not as sexy as leaning into this stuff. So I think finding the balance is important.
What's interesting is with a YouTuber, for example, it's like they are the content in many cases, right? So like if they have a take that is assigned, you know, like a particular like persuasion of identity, you know, like you could expect them to then take on, you know, that perspective in talking about this story, and it would be appropriate for their audience and they would probably be comfortable with that. But if you're a website that provides information or news or whatever, you know, it's not a person that's the product in this case.
So that's
true. You may just be trying to provide information. But you do have like Slate or Vanity Fair or somebody like that, that, you know, like their brand is sort of like they have a certain like lean to the types of information, how they, you know, like write about it. And there is a balance there to be had. But for publishers that are, you know, maybe more traditionally information based, you know, like there's opportunities in topical news, but like, how do you, you know, like how do you approach that with something that actually has an angle for your audience that like maybe doesn't separate them because maybe your audience is split
and you don't want to be polarizing. Yeah, you have a diverse audience. You bring up a really good point. Like, I feel like YouTubers, TikTokers, influencers, they have a persona and they're readers, viewers, users are drawn to that persona and expect that type of content with the ideas that they've shared previously.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, for most of our publishers, I'm assuming, you know, they have this diverse audience from all over. Yeah. And so you don't want to be, you know, too extremist one side or the other, or, you know, tapping into clickbaity headlines, because then you might lose part of your readers.
Yeah. And I think the balance to be had is probably going to be different for, you know, like I know our listener base is probably like all over the map in terms of mm-hmm. different types of content that are produced. But, you know, I think that like Bud Light probably brings us a really good example of like every type of person that drinks beer, probably you can think of like that category of person. Probably at least some percentage drink Bud Light, mm-hmm. right? And so when Bud Light had the Devaney, like what was the influencer that they sent them Devaney, right?
Yeah, I can't remember the name.
I think it's Dylan Devaney or something like that. I probably get that wrong. So listeners, just assume I got it wrong. But when they started working with that influencer, there was like a huge pushback from a good mm-hmm. contingent of their beer drinkers. And, you know, I think we've seen with brands over time, they almost always recover from any kind of boycott or backlash or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the thing was, is that it was jarring to their audience for them, for whatever reason, that there was this disconnect between sort of like what they thought they were and then something that they saw. And I think mm-hmm. that's the careful point that I think publishers that, you know, maybe want to take advantage of maybe new tools or data that tell them like these are topics or these are subjects that you can get into. Your audience, you know, especially on the web, I don't know that they recover in the same way that like a major like retail brand recovers mm. because I think content to a certain extent is a commodity. And if you burn somebody that maybe is, you know, a return visitor or something like that because they are like they don't align with my values or beliefs, like they may truly not ever want to read your content again mm-hmm. because they may view it as biased or slanted or trying to like trick their mind.
Yeah.
Don't try to fool me.
Yeah.
Don't try to get me with your magic voodoo tricks and convince me that I think something that I don't. So,
but how would you suggest that publishers tap into their audience and try and understand who they are? What's the best way for them to do that?
I really feel for publishers actually, because of the Google paradox where you are one step removed, where mm-hmm. you don't necessarily get that traffic from search results because, you know, like it's popular with an audience. Google decided it was popular,
right.
Or Google decided for the audience what they would see. Mm-hmm. And so like you're not getting that feedback and it's a disservice. I would say one of the ways that everybody can do it is by looking actually at their data. So you can look at things like your writers, your topics, your subjects, the categories, mm-hmm. and look at sort of like engagement metrics with it. So like, you know, length of time reading, if you have videos on the page or people watching the videos, like what does that tell you about the content? If there's videos on the page and people aren't watching them for the most part, like what, you know, maybe what are your takeaways on that? And I think it's going to be different for every single site. There's no like broad-based, like this amount of time reading an article or this, you know, whatever. I think you need to slice it up and look at all the information because you're actually the best interpreter of your data. Like, mm-hmm. what does that mean? If you have one writer that seems to always produce articles that are more popular, more engaging and make more money, then like you could probably figure out what is that writer doing that the others aren't. And maybe that tells you something about the content. Maybe it tells you something about the writing style. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but that's what I'm a big fan of that everybody can do.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think the data is really important. You know, I've worked with lots of publishers and I feel like people have a tendency to look at or listen to the vocal minority to make decisions rather than looking at the data.
Yeah.
So, you know, if someone comments on one article on your site and says, I absolutely hate this, let's not use that to make further content decisions. Let's look and see what's the engagement on that page. Are users reading the entire article? Are they staying? Is it producing revenue for your site? I think that's a much more holistic way of looking at things.
Yeah.
But it's easy to, you know, that's an interaction that I think everyone enjoys interactions with people, and also probably has more, you know, more of an impact on you than just looking at Google Analytics or big data analytics. But yeah, I would just caution people to not use that to make decisions, unless you have, you know, if you have a very active forum or lots of comments back and forth. And I think that's the benefit that, you know, YouTubers and TikTokers have, is there's so much interaction and engagement on every post. Yeah, back and forth. And publishers don't get that.
And it also allows you to ignore things easier as well. So like a publisher that maybe gets one comment on something and it's the only one they got, you know, in a week or something. Yeah. It's like you have a tendency to maybe like overreact to that feedback.
Exactly.
But on YouTube, you know, it's like YouTube comments are like, they're hell on earth. So it's very easy to sort of ignore negative feedback there if it doesn't seem to be like consistent. I feel for publishers in that way. And I think that that's something that Google has maybe like robbed them of a little bit.
Hey, my name is Terrence, business intelligence analyst here at Azoic. Want to get the best insights with your website to maximize your revenue? Azoic Ads with Big Data Analytics is your answer to that question. Did you know publishers that spend at least 2 hours in our Big Data Analytics earn, on average, 10 times more than publishers that have never used it before? With our analytics, tie revenue to everything, whether it be SEO insights, best performance of your authors, the location of your users, and much more. Look at your data like you never have before. Check out more information in the description below and try Big Data Analytics in your Azoic account today.
Speaking of our good friends at Google, our last story, and I've connected these two because to me they are very connected. Although I don't know that everybody else would maybe draw these lines, but we talked a little bit about this a few weeks ago. But the Canadian government followed suit with what we've seen in Australia, and the EU has been trying to do this a little bit as well, but forcing social media companies or big tech platforms to pay publishers for displaying their news in a news feed or a search result. And to me, it's incredibly misguided because it aids the big tech platforms because it gives them a strong negotiation position. Oh, well, we have to pay? Great. Well, like that makes it pretty easy for us. Hey, New York Times, we want to pay you this to show your news results. And New York Times is like, no. And they're like, all right, cool. Washington Post, you know, and it's like, you know, well, now you've lost out on, you know, audience, and you've given, you know, Facebook and Google the ability to negotiate, race to the bottom on price. Mm-hmm. And somebody will always be willing to put their content up and be paid for it. So to me, the law already is sort of flawed from the beginning. But, you know, the whole negotiation position with Google and Facebook, you know, first they're, you know, response was, we're just going to pull out of these countries and news. Mm-hmm. And then they started to maybe work with publishers a little bit. But now Google is testing an AI tool that actually writes news articles. So is this checkmate then to these governments that have been trying to put them in check a little bit?
Maybe. I mean, the Google AI tool, I think their goal was to, or like, offer to sell it to people like the New York Times and the Washington Post, right? Sell the news articles to them to then display on Google search results. So it's like,
brilliant.
To be honest, I didn't really understand the decision making behind the Canadian government. I feel like this has such a major impact on small local news publishers, who at this point, I would assume, are driving most of their revenue from advertising from users sent by Google to their website. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think they're making a ton of money selling newspapers, you know. So this just really hurts those publishers And I didn't really understand why the Canadian government didn't see what they were doing and the impact that they could have on these smaller guys.
Yeah. And if you want to go back and listen to previous episodes, if maybe this is the first time you've heard us talk about this topic, I went pretty deep on sort of like where I think regulation, especially like even the most thoughtful and expert sort of led regulation in this space is still potentially more harmful than good. In many cases, GDPR being a really good example where it's like it was legislation designed to essentially tax the large tech companies, you know, is a response to users giving them data, which became a product, which, you know, would have been GDP for, you know, the EU had it been an actual product, not based from an American company. But the implementation of it actually just created a burden for independent publishers, of which are in many cases EU citizens and businesses. And big tech sort of like was the one that benefited because now they can define what those regulations and how it's implemented looks like. So they just gave them a stronger foothold over, you know, European businesses. And I think this is not too much different. And your point about like Genesis is the name of the tool that Google has. And the idea of them then selling news publishers the news to then show in the results. I mean, it's a great business. It just seems like an evil plot from a movie. And
For sure.
And
because they can't post their own news content, right? And then display it in search results. But they could have the New York Times post it and pay for it and then show it.
It seems like such a mob move.
I know it is.
We're not going to come and mess up your store here, but like you could pay for protection.
Yeah,
or we would keep someone from coming and messing up your store.
Exactly.
It does feel like a shakedown. I do wonder a little bit too about, you know, I know publishers have concerns about AI writing content, and I think, you know, listening to this podcast, and I think largely, you know, have understood that this is something they have to embrace to some degree.
Yes, definitely.
And really use it as a tool. And I think if you're not, you know, the thing that I encourage constantly, and, you know, I want to get your thoughts before we finish here on AI, but the thing that I think about with this is you need to be experimenting with it as a tool. And that this needs to be something that you almost look at as like going to the gym, where it's like, every week, every day, you should be investing time and energy into figuring out, like, how do I use this tool to help me make my publishing business better? Because if you're not, it's what we talked about in the beginning, where somebody else will. And this could be an exponential gap between you and other people in your space in a year if you don't take it seriously.
I agree 100%. And especially in publishing, I think there's a lot you can do with it. But I even tell my friends, my team, everyone, you should be spending minimum 20 to 30 minutes a day using it for whatever you need.
Yeah.
Try different things. Because I do think it's here to stay. It's going to change a lot of things. And I think it can make everyone, especially publishers, 10, 20 times more productive than they are right now.
Yeah.
Especially with content generation. You know, that's an easy one. But then, you know, getting into the code of websites, that's something that they can use it for. So if you're not a developer and you need to make some changes on your website, you now have a tool that can help you that costs far less than outsourcing it to a dev team.
It's like what we talked about earlier, you know, like this is sort of maybe the great equalizer. This sort of like balances the complexity and the freedom of, you know, like advanced technology with sort of like the burden of like needing to be able to wrangle it. You all of a sudden have this like magical tool that can do it for you. And you and I were talking about this maybe last Friday, but one of the things that's interesting about it is like if you're using it from a development angle and you don't traditionally have a development background, you don't have to know everything to be able to have it do work for you, but you'll probably start learning a lot along the way and seeing how different things are implemented. And that's one of the real benefits I see in it as well. And I'm just curious, like, is there anything else that you found, whether it's like in the workplace personally or anything like that, that you've began using it for or anything like that?
So I lead the sales team and we do a lot of outreach to publishers. And you know, one of the things that we want to know is, what is this website about? And have we communicated with them in the past? You know, what is this? What's the publisher's persona? Do they have other websites? We've been able to take all of that information into ChatGPT and summarize, who is this publisher? What are they interested in? What is their site about? And that's been really interesting to now have sort of like a persona of the publisher. This kind of goes back to like the difference between publishers and YouTubers. It's easy to know who a YouTuber is because it's their face right there. It's harder to understand who a publisher is, but we have been able to get what we think is like a decent idea of who they are and what's important to them. And then in my personal life, not so much, but really just, I've been trying to use it instead of Google for certain things, just to see how it acts and what sort of responses I get. And especially now with the plugins to get real-time information into ChatGPT-4, that's been really interesting.
Yeah, the plugins are a huge, huge help, because it sometimes you don't want a chatbot response, but you need something done, or you want something in particular, and the plugins give you a new feature set, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think the coding aspect of it, I don't code, but I write, MySQL queries.
Yeah.
It's very helpful with that.
It's great for that.
And so instead of all this, you know, trial and error, like, why isn't this query working? I can now just ask it and it'll give me what I need. And then I just plug it in. So that's amazing.
You really just need the back of a napkin sort of like understanding of so many things, like development and programming languages. And you can do so much with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty incredible. Personally, I've found that it can make cocktail recipes, unique ones. Some good, some bad. I'd say like 50-50 there.
You're taste testing them all.
Yeah, I'm taste testing. I will tell it to make like a certain type of cocktail. And I'll say, to your knowledge, I want you to produce one that will be good, but has never existed before.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. And when you see like carrots or something like that, you're like, no, I don't think so. Maybe you missed the mark here.
I think just the time saving aspect of it is something that if people aren't using it, they're missing out on.
Yeah.
And like you said, that gap is going to widen between the people who understand how to use it and become so much more effective and productive, and the people who don't. So for example, like I had to write a letter of rec for someone, and normally that would take me probably 30 minutes to put everything together, you know, make sure it said what I wanted to say. And I was able to just put bullet points in about like the main main attributes that this person had and the value that they brought to any organization. And then share a few like specific examples that I wanted it to include.
Yeah.
So within 3 minutes I had it, and it sound, you know, I think I'm a decent writer, but it sounded so much more eloquent than I would be able to put together on my own, which is a great thing, because this is going to this person's future employer, and it, you know, it's this beautifully written letter of rec.
Yeah. And I have a model where I've fed it all the blogs that I've written from multiple different sources and stuff like that. And it writes like me better than me, you know, and I think you have to like kind of get past a little bit of the ego that says like, you know, only I could do this or whatever, because it can. And I think you can definitely guide it, but it does actually allow for more, I think, human like elements into things by removing sort of like the productive parts, like, you know, writing something. It's like, you know, like I like writing. And I also think like, we don't want to lose sort of like human communication. But like actually typing out the prose and sort of like the act of typing, that is not the part that's human. That's work. And I think that's the thing that I would encourage our publishers to probably spend time thinking about, is trying to make your mind default to, how do I use AI to do this, as opposed to, how do I complete this work? And then AI maybe secondary to that. It's like, how can I have AI speed up this thing that I need to accomplish?
Yeah, I've used it. Like, I think this would resonate with publishers. I've used it to create outlines for me.
Yeah.
So I'll give it a topic and then say, you know, like, can you outline 5 main points. Here's some ideas of what I want each point to be about, which if you're writing an article, having an outline of what should go in each section is so helpful. If you want to go write it, now you don't have to spend the time doing that. You can have it generated for you and then go do the part you enjoy, which might be filling that in.
Yeah. And even research as well, to where it's like, you know, to really strengthen the value of your content, being able to say, I'm writing about this. Are there any studies, metrics, you know, information that I can reference here that would support sort of this point or whatever? I've used it a few times in creating presentations because one of the things I like to do is I like to like give an example of something that's like a parallel, but like not industry related. So there was one here recently where I wanted to talk about where everybody missed something and it was a disaster. And like I asked it, I was like, what are historical examples of something where everybody missed something that was really important and there was a disaster? And it like spit out a whole bunch. It's like the Challenger exploding, you know, like different things like that. And it's like, perfect, you know. Otherwise, it's just my mind cycling through historical events that I can kind of maybe draw those parallels with, but it just spits out like 10. I'm like, oh, that's a good one. Yeah. That's a good one.
It's so helpful.
Yeah. And I think that, yeah, I think everything in this space has changed a lot, but I think the fundamentals still remain the same. And I think that that's, you know, trying to separate sort of what's new and then what's a fundamental is probably what's important for publishers. And I bet you probably agree with that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, in the 10 years I've been in the space, like content is still king. And, you know, updating your content, having new content, relevant content, that is so important. And it's easy to get sucked into the weeds of what's my LCP score and how do I improve that one point. But at the end of the day, your time is better spent getting good content, maybe with the help of AI, to your users, because that's what they want.
Yeah. And I think that that's a good like line to draw between spending your time wisely versus like, you know, maybe getting caught up in like the latest and greatest new stuff. Is like you said, content is king, you know, like that's the fixture of like what runs your business. It's the lifeblood. But thanks for joining us on the podcast.
That was so fun. Yeah. My first podcast.
Well, yeah, we'll have to
hopefully I'll be back soon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that our listeners, if you have questions for Piper or just questions in general for the show, if you go to publisherlab.org,
Find me on Twitter and Threads now.
We talked about how you can be easily findable on Threads. And you can leave us questions or comments based on the show. And any questions or comments for Piper, we'll wrestle her back over here and we'll do another episode and she can answer them directly. And any questions for the show, those are always great. Helps me make sure that we're producing and making the content that you guys like. And you can find us on pretty much everywhere you find or listen to podcasts. And if you have never checked out the show on YouTube, check it out. Which reminds me, kick check. Piper is currently barefoot. Yeah. I've got the Travis Scott Air Trainers.
Nice.
Yeah.
So those are cool.
Yeah. These are like my favorite. These things are so durable. We have, I think, one publisher, but maybe a contingent of publishers that always want to know what Nike's got. So they press me now. It's like I try to go through my collection and just figure out, do I have something new to show? And it's, you know,
I love that.
I'm running low on the rotation, but I got a couple new ones for you. Coming podcast listener or listeners. But that's it. And thanks, everyone, for joining on another episode of The Publisher Lab.